Duncan spun around, startled at being discovered here. Leto's voice caught in his throat in time to squelch a chiding speech. He meant to demand what the boy was doing here, unsupervised and without permission. Then Leto saw Duncan's wide eyes, with the tracks of tears running like salty tributaries down his face. Embarrassed, but filled with pride, the young man stood up straighter.
"I am sorry, my lord Duke."
His voice was full of sorrow and much deeper than any child's had a right to be. He looked down at the sword, and then through the arched columns into the dining hall, where the portrait of dashing Paulus Atreides hung on the far wall. The hawkish patriarch stared from the painting with burning green eyes. He wore his gaudy matador clothes, as if nothing in the universe could knock him from his intended course.
"I miss him very much," Duncan said.
Feeling a lump in his throat that gradually expanded to become a leaden weight in his chest, Leto approached the boy. Paulus had left his mark upon many lives. Even this youth who worked with the bulls, a mere boy who had somehow managed to outwit Harkonnen hunters and escape from Gedi Prime, felt the loss like a mortal wound.
"I am not the only one who still feels the pain of my father's death," Leto realized.
He clasped Duncan's shoulder, and in silence they spoke more than hours of conversation could have communicated. Duncan finally pulled away and leaned on the tall sword as if it were a crutch. His flushed skin returned to its normal tone, and he drew a deep breath.
I came to ask you a question, my lord, before you go to Kaitane."
Pots clanged in the distance, and servants moved about. Before long, someone would come up to Leto's room bearing a breakfast tray. They would find his room empty.
"Ask," he said.
"It's about the bulls, sir.
With Iresk gone now, I've been tending them every day, me and some of the other stable boys.
But what do you mean to do with them? Will you fight the bulls just like your father?"
"No," Leto said quickly, as a bolt of fear shot through him. He pushed the reflex away.
"No," he repeated more calmly. "I think not. The days of bullfighting on Caladan are over."
"Then what shall I do, my lord?" Duncan said. "Do I still need to tend the animals?"
Leto tried not to laugh. At his age, the boy should be playing, doing a few chores, and filling his head with imaginings of the grand adventures that awaited him in life. But when Leto looked into Duncan's eyes, he saw that the person before him was far more than just a boy. He was much older inside.
"You've eluded Harkonnens in their prison city, correct?"
Duncan nodded, biting his lower lip.
"You fought them in a forest preserve when you were only 8 years of age. You killed several. And if I remember your story right, you cut a tracking device out of your own shoulder and laid a trap for Harkonnen hunters. You humiliated Glossu Rabban himself."
Again Duncan nodded, not with pride, but simply confirming the summary of events.
"And you found your way across the Imperium, coming here to Caladan because this is where you wanted to be. Even the distance of several continents didn't divert you from our doorstep."
"All that is true, my lord Duke."
Leto indicated the large ceremonial sword.
"My father used that blade for training."
"It's overlarge for you, at least for now, Duncan. But perhaps with some instruction, you could become a formidable fighter. A duke is always in need of trustworthy guards and protectors." He pursed his lips, considering.
"Do you think you're fit to be one of mine?"
The boy's blue-green eyes shone and he grinned, crinkling his skin around the drying tracks of tears.
Will you send me to the weapon schools of Ginaz so I can become a swordmaster?
Ho ho!
Leto gave a booming laugh that startled his own ears, because it sounded so much like his father's. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, Duncan Idaho. We'll train you here to the limit of your abilities. Then we'll see if you're good enough for such a reward. Duncan nodded solemnly. I will be good enough. As Leto heard servants bustling by in the dining room, he raised a hand to signal them over. He would breakfast with this boy and chat some more. You can count on me, my Duke. Leto drew a long, deep breath. He wished he could share the unshakable confidence of this young man. Yes, Duncan, I believe you. Innovations seem to have a life and a sentience of their own. When conditions are right, a radical new idea, a paradigm shift, may appear simultaneously from many minds at once. Or it may remain secret in the thoughts of one man for years, decades, centuries, until someone else thinks of the same thing. How many brilliant discoveries die stillborn, or lie dormant, never to be embraced by the Imperium as a whole. Ombudsman of Richese, rebuttal to the Landsrad, the true domain of the intellect, private property, or resources for the galaxy. The tube transport dropped its two passengers into the depths of Harkonnen Keep, and then, with programmed precision, shot them across an access rail. The capsule, with the Baron and Glossu Rabban inside, raced toward the swarming morass of Harko City, a smoky blot on the landscape where buildings crowded together. To the Baron's knowledge, there was no detailed map of the city's underworld, since it continued to grow like a fungus. He wasn't sure exactly where they were going. While scheming against the Atreides, he had insisted that Peter de Vries find extensive yet confidential laboratory space and fabrication facilities in the armpit of Harkonnen influence. The Mentat said he'd done so, and the Baron didn't ask further questions. This tube transport dispatched by de Vries was taking them there.
"I want to know the whole plan, Uncle," Rabban said, fidgeting next to him in the compartment. "Tell me what we're going to do."
Up front in the piloting cubicle, a deaf-mute vehicle specialist hurried them along. The Baron paid no attention to the dark and blocky buildings flashing by, the clouds of exhaust and residue spilling from the factories. Geedy Prime produced sufficient goods to pay for itself, and tidy sums came in from the whale fur trade on Lankavile and mineral excavation on various asteroids. The really big profits for House Harkonnen, however, dwarfing all the others combined, were from spice exploitation on Arrakis.
"The plan, Rabban, is simple," he answered finally, "and I intend to offer you a key part in it, if you can handle it."
His nephew's heavy-lidded eyes lit up, and his thick lips twisted his generous mouth into a grin. Surprisingly, he knew enough to remain quiet and wait for the Baron to continue. Maybe, eventually, he'll learn. "If we succeed in this, Rabban, our fortunes will increase dramatically. Better still, we can take personal satisfaction in knowing that we have at last ruined House Atreides after all these centuries of feuding." Rabban rubbed his hands in delight. But the Baron's black stare became harder as he continued. "If you fail, however, I'll see to it that you're transferred back to Lankavile, where you'll be trained any way your father wishes, complete with sing-alongs and the recitation of poems about brotherly love." Rabban glowered. "I won't fail, Uncle." The tube car arrived at an armored high-security laboratory, and the deaf-mute motioned for them to exit the vehicle. The Baron couldn't have found his way back to Harkonnen Keep if his life had depended upon it.
"What is this place?" Rabban asked.
"A research establishment," the Baron said, waving him forward. "One where we are preparing a nasty surprise."
Rabban marched ahead, eager to see the facility. The place smelled of solder and waste oil, blown fuses and sweat. From the cluttered open floor, Peter de Vries came up to greet them, stained lips smiling. His mincing footsteps and slithery, jerky movements gave him the demeanor of a lizard.
"You've had weeks here already, Peter. This had better be good. I told you not to waste my time."
"And not to worry, my Baron," the Mentat answered, gesturing for them to come deeper into the building's high bay. "Our pet researcher Chobin has outdone himself.
And I always thought Rachesians were better at cheap imitations than actual innovations," Rabban said.
"There are exceptions everywhere," the Baron said. "Let's see what Peter has to show us." Filling most of the chamber was what de Vries had secretly promised the Baron. A modified Harkonnen warship, 140 meters in diameter. Sleek and highly polished, this craft had been used to good effect in conventional battles to strike hard and escape quickly. Now it had been converted according to Chobin's exacting specifications, with its tail fins trimmed, the engine replaced, and a section of the troop cabin cut away to make room for the required technology. All records of the craft's existence had been expunged from Harkonnen ledgers. Peter de Vries was good at manipulations like that. A rotund man with a bald pate and steel-gray goatee emerged from the engine compartment of the attack ship, stained with grease and other lubricants.
"My Baron, sir, I'm pleased you have come to see what I've accomplished for you."
Chobin tucked a tool into the pocket of his overalls.
"Installation is complete. My no-field will operate perfectly. I've synchronized it with the machinery of this ship."
Rabban rapped his knuckles on the hull near the cockpit.
"Why is it so big?"
"This hulk is large enough to carry an armored ground car unit. How are we going to do any secret work with this?"
Chobin raised his eyebrows, not recognizing the burly young man.
"And you are?"
"This is Rabban, my nephew," the Baron said. "He raises a valid question. I asked for a small stealth ship."
"This is the tiniest I could make it," Chobin answered with a huff.
140 meters is the smallest cloak of invisibility the no-field generator can project. The constraints are incredible.
The inventor cleared his throat, suddenly impatient.
"You must learn to think beyond your preconception, sir. Realize what we have here. Naturally, the invisibility more than makes up for any diminished maneuvering capability."
He wrinkled his brow again.
"What difference does the size make if no one can see it anyway? This attack craft will still fit easily inside the hold of a frigate."
"It will do, Chobin," the Baron said, "if it works." De Vries scuttled back and forth along the length of the ship.
"If no one knows to look for the ship, Rabban, you won't be in any danger. Imagine the chaos you can create. You'll be like a killer ghost."
"Oh, yes." Rabban paused as realization flooded across his face.
"Me?"
Chobin closed an access hatch behind the engines.
"Everything is simple and functional. The ship will be ready by tomorrow when you depart for the Padishah Emperor's coronation."
"I have verified it, my Baron," de Vries said.
"Excellent," the Baron said. "You have proven yourself most valuable, Chobin."
"I'm going to pilot it," Rabban said again, as if he still couldn't believe the idea. His voice cracked with excitement.
Baron Harkonnen nodded. His nephew, despite his shortcomings, was at least an excellent pilot and an excellent shot, along with being the Baron's heir apparent.
The inventor smiled.
"I believe I made the correct choice in coming to you directly, Baron. House Harkonnen has immediately seen the possibilities of my discovery.
When the new Emperor learns of this, he'll demand a no-ship for himself," Rabban pointed out. "He might even send the Sardaukar in to take it away from us."
Then we must make sure Shaddam doesn't find out. At least not yet, Peter DeVries replied, rubbing his hands together.
You must be a brilliant man, Chobin, the Baron said, coming up with all this.
Actually, I just adapted a Holtzman field to our uses. Centuries ago, T.O. Holtzman's mathematics were developed for shields and fold space engines. I simply carried the principles several steps further.
And now you expect to become wealthy beyond your wildest dreams? The Baron mused.
Deservedly so, would you not agree, Baron? Chobin said.
Look what I've done for you. If I'd stayed on Richies and gone through channels, I would have had to endure years of legalities, title searches, and patent investigations, after which my government would have taken the lion's share of profit derived from my own invention, not to speak of the imitators who would set to work once they got wind of what I was doing. A minor adjustment here, another there, and then someone else has a different patent, one that accomplishes essentially the same thing.
So you kept it a secret until you came to us, Raban said. No one else knows of the technology.
I'd have been foolish to tell anyone else. You have the only no-field generators in the universe.
Chobin crossed his arms over his stained jumpsuit.
Perhaps for the time being, the Baron said, but the Ixians were a clever lot, and so are the Tleilaxu. Sooner or later, someone else will have something like this, if they don't already.
Raban maneuvered himself closer to the unwary Richesian.
I see your point, Baron, Chobin said with a shrug. I am not a greedy man, but I would like to profit from my own invention.
You are a wise man, the Baron said, flashing a meaningful glance at his burly nephew, and deserve to be paid in full.
It's good to keep secrets about important things, Raban chimed in.
He stood directly behind the rotund inventor, who beamed at the praise and wiped his hands on his pant legs.
Raban moved swiftly, like a whiplash, wrapping his muscular forearm around Chobin's neck, then squeezed tightly like a vice. The inventor gasped, but could make no other sound. Raban's face reddened with the strain as he pulled back with his arm until he was rewarded with the loud crack of a crushed spine.
"We must all be more careful with our secrets, Chobin," the Baron muttered, smiling. "You haven't been careful enough."
Like a broken doll, Chobin collapsed with only a rustle of his clothes to the oil-stained floor. Raban had been so forceful that Chobin gurgled no death rattle, gasped out no final curses.
"Was that wise, my Baron?" DeVries asked. "Shouldn't we have tested the ship first, to make sure we can reproduce the technology?"
"Why, don't you trust our inventor, the late Chobin?"
"It works," Raban said. "Besides, you've had him under Kamai surveillance, and we have the detailed plans and holo recordings he made during the construction process."
"I've already taken care of the workers," the Mentat said, nodding in agreement. "No chance for leaks there."
Raban smiled greedily.
"Did you save me any of them?"
DeVries gave a jittering shrug.
"Well, I've had my fun, but I'm not a pig. I did leave a few for you."
He nodded toward a bank of solid doors.
"Second room on the right. Five of them are in there on gurneys, drugged. Enjoy yourself."
The Mentat patted the beefy Harkonnen on the shoulder. Raban took a couple of steps toward the door, then hesitated and looked back at his uncle, who had not yet given permission for him to leave. The Baron was studying DeVries. The twisted Mentat furrowed his brow.
"We are the first with a no-ship, my Baron. With the advantage of surprise, no one will ever suspect what it is we intend to do."
"What I'm going to do," Raban said gruffly. DeVries used a handheld comm unit to speak to several sluggish workers in the lab.
"Clean up this mess and get the attack ship moved to the family frigate before departure time tomorrow." I want all technical notes and records confiscated and sealed, the Baron ordered as the Mentat switched off the communicator.
Yes, my Baron, De Vries said. I'll see to it personally.
You may go now, the Baron said to his anxious nephew. An hour or two of relaxation will do you good. It'll get your mind in order for the important work ahead. They demonstrate subtle, highly effective skills in the aligned arts of observation and data collection. Information is their stock in trade. Imperial report on the Bene Gesserit, used for tutoring purposes.
This is most impressive, Sister Margaret Rashino Zia said, as she gazed at the imposing buildings on each side of the enormous oval of the Imperial Landsrad Commons. A spectacle for all the senses.
After long years on the cloudy, bucolic world of Wallach IX, her eyes now ached from so many sights. A refreshing, fine mist rose from the fountain at the center of the commons, an extraordinary artistic composition that towered 100 meters overhead. In the design of a glittering nebulous whirl, the fountain was replete with oversized planets and other celestial bodies that spurted perfumed streams in myriad colors. Tight beam spotlights refracted from the water, creating loops of rainbows that danced silently in the air.
Ah, yes, you have never been to Kaitain, I see, Crown Prince Shaddam said, strolling casually beside the lovely blonde Bene Gesserit.
Sardaukar guards hovered in the background, assuming they were near enough to prevent any harm from coming to the Imperial air. Margaret suppressed a smile, always pleased to see how much other people underestimated the sisterhood.
Oh, I've seen it before, sire, but familiarity does not lessen my admiration for the magnificent capital of the Imperium.
Dressed in a new black robe that rustled stiffly as she moved, Margaret was flanked by Shaddam on one side and Hasimir Fenring on the other. She did not hide her long golden hair, her fresh face, or her pristine beauty. Most of the time, people expected the Bene Gesserit to be old hags shrouded in layers of dark garments. But many, like Margaret Rashino Zia, could be stunningly attractive. With a precise release of her body's pheromones and carefully selected flirtations, she could use her sexuality as a weapon. But not here. Not yet. The sisterhood had other plans for the emperor-to-be. Margaret was nearly Shaddam's height, and much taller than Fenring. Behind them, out of hearing range, an entourage of 3 reverend mothers followed, women who had been investigated and cleared by Fenring himself. The crown prince did not know what these others had to do with this meeting, but Margaret would convey the reason presently.
You should see these gardens at night, Shaddam said. The water looks like a meteor shower.
Oh, yes, Margaret said with a faint smile.
Her gray-green eyes glittered.
This is my favorite place to be in the evenings. I have come twice since my arrival here, in anticipation of this private meeting with you, sire.
Though he tried to make casual conversation with this representative of the powerful Bene Gesserit, Shaddam felt ill at ease. Everyone wanted something, everyone had a private agenda, and every group thought it was owed favors or held sufficient blackmail material to sway his opinion. Fenring had already taken care of several of those parasites, but more would come. His current uneasiness had less to do with Sister Margaret than with his concerns over mounting mistrust and turmoil among the great houses. Even without an autopsy by the Sooks, several important members of the Landsrad had raised uncomfortable questions over the Emperor's mysterious, lingering death. Alliances were shifting and reforming. Important taxes and tithes from several wealthy worlds had been delayed, without adequate explanation. And the Tleilaxu claimed to be years away from producing their promised synthetic spice.
Shaddam and his inner council would discuss the brewing crisis again this morning, a continuation of meetings that had gone on for a week. The length of Elrood's reign had forced a stability, if not stagnation, across the Imperium. No one remembered how to implement an orderly transition of power. All across the world, military forces were being increased in strength and placed on alert. Shaddam Sardaukar were no exception. Spies were busier than ever in all quarters. At times he wondered if his reassignment of Elrood's trusted chamberlain, Akin Hezban, might have been a mistake. Hezban now sat in a tiny, rock-walled office deep in the gullet of an asteroid mine, ready to be recalled if things ever got too bad. But it'll be a cold day on Arrakis before that happens. Shaddam's unease made him jumpy, perhaps a little superstitious. His old vulture of a father was dead, sent to the deepest hell described in the Orange Catholic Bible. Yet still he felt the invisible blood on his hands. Before departing the palace to meet with Sister Margot, Shaddam had, without much thought, grabbed a cloak to warm his shoulders against an imagined chill in the morning air. The gold mantle had hung in the wardrobe with many other garments he had never worn. Only now did he remember that this particular article had been a favorite of his father's. Realizing this, Shaddam's skin crawled. He felt the fine material prickle him suddenly, making him shiver. The fine gold chain seemed to tighten at his throat like a noose. Ridiculous, he told himself. Inanimate objects did not carry spirits of the dead. Couldn't possibly harm him. He tried to put such concerns out of his mind. The Bene Gesserit would certainly be able to read his discomfort, and he couldn't allow this woman so much power over him. "I love the artwork here," Margot said. She pointed toward a scaffold fixed to the face of the Landsrad Hall of Oratory, where fresco painters worked on a mural depicting scenes of natural beauty and technological achievement from around the Imperium. "I believe your great-grandfather, Vutier Corino II, was responsible for much of this." "Ah, yes, Vutier was a great patron of the arts," Shaddam said with some difficulty. Resisting an urge to remove the haunted cloak and throw it to the ground, he vowed to wear only his own clothes henceforth. He said that spectacle without warmth or creativity meant nothing. "I think you should make your point, please, sister," Fenring suggested, noting his friend's discomfort, but guessing incorrectly as to its cause. "The Crown Prince's time is valuable. There is much turmoil after the Emperor's death." Shaddam and Fenring had murdered Elrood IX. That fact could never be erased. And they hadn't escaped suspicion entirely, not according to rumors. War between the Landsrad and House Corino might result unless the Crown Prince consolidated his position, and soon. Margot had been so persistent about the importance of a certain matter, using all the quiet clout of the Bene Gesserit, that an audience had been granted to her on short notice. The only time open was during one of Shaddam's morning walks, an hour he normally reserved for quiet personal reflection. Grief for his dead father, according to the court gossip Fenring had fostered. Margot favored the weasel-faced man beside her with a pretty smile and a casual toss of her honey-blonde hair. Her gray-green eyes studied him. "You know very well what I wish to discuss with your friend Hasimir," she said, employing a familiar tone that astonished the imperial heir. "Didn't you prepare him?" Fenring shook his head jerkily, and Shaddam saw him weaken in her presence. The deadly man wasn't his usual forceful self. The Bene Gesserit delegation had been here for some days, waiting, and Margot Rashino Zia had spent a great deal of time with Fenring in close discussions. Shaddam cocked his head, sensing some affection, or at least mutual respect, between the two. "Impossible."
I thought you might phrase it better than I could, sister, Fenring said. Sire, the lovely Margaret has an interesting proposal for you. I think you should listen to her. The Bene Gesserit looked at Shaddam strangely. Has she noticed my distress? He wondered, suddenly panicked. Does she know the reason for my feelings? The sigh of the fountain drowned out their words. Margaret took Shaddam's hands in hers, and they were pleasingly soft and warm to him. Gazing into her sensual eyes, he felt her strength flow back into him, a comfort. "You must have a wife, sire," she said, "and the Bene Gesserit can provide the best match for you and House Carino." Startled, Shaddam glanced over at his friend and snatched his hands back. Fenring smiled uneasily. "Soon you will be crowned emperor," Margaret continued. "The sisterhood can help you secure your power base more than an alliance with any single great house of the Landsrat. During his life, your father married into the Muteli, Hagal, and Ekaz families, as well as your own mother from Hasika V. However, in these difficult times, we believe you would gain the greatest advantage by allying your throne with the power and resources of the Bene Gesserit sisterhood." She spoke firmly, convincingly. He noticed that the entourage of sisters had stopped a distance away and stood watching them. Out of earshot, the Sardaukar remained watchful but motionless, like statues. He looked at Margaret's perfectly formed face, her golden hair, her hypnotic presence. She surprised him by turning back to the entourage and pointing. "Do you see the woman in the center over there, the one with bronze hair?" Noting the gesture, a robed reverend mother stepped forward. Shaddam squinted, assessing her features, her doe-like face. Even from a distance he found her rather attractive, though she was not a classic beauty. Not as lovely as Margaret, unfortunately, but she did seem young and fresh. "Her name is Anirul, a Bene Gesserit of hidden rank."
"What does that mean?"
"It's just one of our titles, sire. Quite common in the sisterhood. It means nothing outside the order and is irrelevant to your work as emperor."
Margaret paused a beat.
"You need only know that Anirul is one of our best. We are offering her to you in marriage."
Shaddam felt a jolt of surprise. "What?"
"The Bene Gesserit are quite influential, you know. We can work behind the scenes to smooth over any difficulties you currently have with the Landsrat. This would free you to perform the work of being emperor and secure your place in history. A number of your grandfathers have done this to good effect."
She narrowed her gray-green eyes.
"We are aware of the troubles you currently face, sire."
"Yes, yes, I know all that." He looked over at Fenring, as if the weasel-faced man could explain himself. Then Shaddam beckoned for Anirul herself to come forward. The guards looked at one another uneasily, not knowing whether they should accompany her. In front of him, Margaret's gaze intensified.
"You are now the most powerful man in the universe, sire, but your political rule is balanced between yourself, the Landsrat Council, and the powerful forces of the Spacing Guild and the Bene Gesserit. Your marriage to one of my sisters would be mutually beneficial."
"Besides, sire," Fenring added, his eyes even larger than usual, "an alliance with any other great house would bring with it certain baggage. You would join with one family at the risk of spurning another. We don't want to trigger another rebellion." Though surprised by the suggestion, Shaddam rather liked the sound of it. One of his father's adages about leadership indicated that a ruler needed to pay attention to his instincts. The haunted cloak hung heavy on his shoulders like a crushing weight. Maybe the witching powers of the sisterhood could ward off whatever malevolent force inhabited the garment and the palace. "This Anirul of yours does have an appealing look to her."
Shaddam watched as the proffered woman stepped forward and stood at silent attention, eyes averted, 5 paces from his royal person.
"Then you will consider our proposal, sire?"
Margaret asked, and took a respectful step back, awaiting his decision.
"Consider it?" Shaddam smiled. "I already have. In my position, decisions must be made quickly and decisively."
He looked at Fenring, narrowing his eyes.
"Wouldn't you agree, Hasimir?"
That depends upon whether you're choosing a new garment or a wife."
"Wise counsel on the surface," Shaddam said to Fenring. "But disingenuous, I think. You are obviously Sister Margaret's friend, and you arranged this meeting knowing full well the request she would make. I must therefore presume you concur with the Bene Gesserit position."
Fenring bowed.
"The decision is yours, sire, no matter my personal opinion or feelings toward this beautiful woman beside me."
"Very well, my answer is yes." Hearing this from where she stood, Reverend Mother Anirul did not even smile. "Do you believe I have made the right choice, Hasimir?" Unaccustomed to being caught off balance, Fenring cleared his throat several times.
"She is a fine lady, sire, and will no doubt make a superb wife. And the Bene Gesserit should make excellent allies, especially in these difficult transition times."
The Crown Prince laughed. "You sound like one of our diplomats. Give me a yes or a no without equivocation."
"Yes, Majesty. That is, I give you a yes without hesitation. Anirul is a woman of fine breeding and disposition. A bit young, but she has a great wisdom about her."
With a glance at Margaret beside him, Fenring said, "You assured me that she can indeed bear children?"
"Royal heirs will flow from her loins," Margaret quipped.
"What an image!" Shaddam exclaimed, with another hearty laugh. "Bring her to me so I can meet her myself."
Margaret raised her hand, and Anirul hurried to the Crown Prince's side. The rest of the Bene Gesserit entourage buzzed with conversation. Shaddam looked at the woman closely, noted that Anirul, his wife-to-be, had delicate features. He noted tiny lines around the doe eyes, though her gaze was youthful and her movements lithe. At the moment she continued to lower her head with its ruffled bronze hair. As if being coy, she looked at the Crown Prince and then away again.
"You have just made one of the best decisions of your life, sire," Margaret said. "Your reign will have a strong foundation."
"This is cause for celebration, with all the pomp and splendor the Imperium can muster," Shaddam said. "In fact, I plan to announce that the marriage will take place on the same day as my coronation."
Fenring beamed.
"It will be the grandest spectacle in Imperial history, my friend."
Shaddam and Anirul exchanged smiles and touched hands for the first time as he reached out to her. When the center of the storm does not move, you are in its path. Ancient Freeman Wisdom. The Atreides frigate departed from Kala City spaceport for the Padishah Emperor's coronation, loaded with an abundance of banners, exquisite clothes, jewels, and gifts. Duke Leto wanted to make sure he contributed visibly to the magnificence of the imperial ceremony.
"It is a good tactic," Thufir Hawat agreed with a grim nod. "Shaddam has always reveled in the trappings of his position. The more finery you wear and the more gifts you present him, the more impressed he'll be, and therefore the more inclined to grant your request."
"He appears to value form over substance," Leto mused. "But appearances can be deceiving, and I dare not underestimate him." Kylea had worn her own gorgeous sky-blue and lilac dress to see them off, but she would remain at the castle with no one to see her finery. Leto could see how much she longed to go to the imperial court,
but he refused to bend in his decision. Old Paulus had taught him stubbornness as well. Romber emerged into the staging area wearing pantaloons, a synthetic mer-silk shirt, and a billowing cape of purple and copper, colors of the lost House Vernius. He stood proudly while Kylia gasped at her brother's bravery for flaunting his family heritage.
He seemed much more a man now, muscular and tanned, without the gentle roundings of baby fat.
"Some might see that as arrogance, my duke," Hawat said, nodding toward Romber's clothes.
"This is all a gamble, Thufir," Leto said. "We need to hark back to the grandeur that was lost when Tleilaxu treachery forced this noble family to go renegade. We must show the short-sightedness of Emperor Elrud's malicious decision. We must help Shaddam see what a great ally House Vernius could be to the imperial throne. After all," he gestured to the proud Romber, "would you rather have this man as your ally, or the filthy Tleilaxu?"
The Master of Assassins favored him with a small, contained smile.
"I wouldn't come out and say that directly to Shaddam."
"We'll say it without words," Leto replied.
"You are going to make a formidable duke, my lord," Hawat said.
They walked together from the staging area to the landing field, where twice the usual complement of Atreides' troops had just finished boarding the frigate that would take them up to the waiting highliner. Kylia came forward and gave Leto a brief, formal hug. Her pastel dress rustled with her movements, and he pressed his cheek against one of the gold combs in her copper-dark hair. He could feel the tension in her arms, and sensed that they both wanted to share a much more passionate embrace. Then, with tears in her eyes, the daughter of Dominic and Shando Vernius clutched her brother even more desperately.
"Be careful, Romber. This is so dangerous."
"This may be the only way we can restore our family name," Romber answered. "We must throw ourselves upon the mercy of Shaddam. Perhaps he'll be different from his father. He has nothing to gain by maintaining the sentence against us, and much to lose, especially with the restlessness in the Imperium. He needs all the friends and strength he can get." He smiled and swirled the purple and copper cape.
"Ix is wasted on the Bene Tleilax," Kylia noted. "They don't have an inkling about how to run a galactic business. Leto, Romber, and Hawat would be representatives from Caladan, brash perhaps, and showy in their impertinence. Or would it be seen as calm confidence? Leto hoped for the latter. As Duke, he knew that flying in the face of court politics was unwise. But his heart told him to gamble when the stakes were important enough, when he was on the side of righteousness, where he always intended to be. The old Duke had taught him no less. His father had shown him that a gambit filled with bravado often paid off far more substantially than a conservative and unimaginative plan. So why not this? Would the old Duke have done something similar? Or would he, guided by his wife, have taken a safer course? Leto had no answer for that, but was thankful that he didn't have anyone like the stern and inflexible Lady Helena getting in his way now. When he decided to marry, it would never be to anyone like her. He had sent a formal courier to the Sisters in Isolation compound on the eastern continent, notifying his mother that he and Romber would journey to Kytane.